fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
Okay, so we're all here. So wait, go back over what you said, because that was some interesting thing that you were talking. You guys were talking about Kickstarter before I logged on.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Corey.
We'll just leave it at that. No.
Yeah. Corey had been talking about how his view is, you know, sort of evolving on the whole Kickstarter matter, you know, versus, you know, these sort of mega projects like the Veronica Mars thing or Zach Braff's movie.
Yeah. And how is it evolving? Because I know you were kind of down on it last week. Right,
yeah,
Corey?
Right. I think what's changing, Jamal Eigel, who is a comic book artist, and he's working on Molly Danger, which looks like a really fun sort of preteen superhero, female superhero comic.
Yeah, we may get a chance to have him on the podcast. Actually.
Oh, wonderful. Excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
And he has, you know, he's made a career for himself. He's drawn Superman and other DC and Marvel books. And And he responded to a column that was posted, I think, at comicbook.com, I think, by, I guess, Kevin Smith, I suppose. I guess Kevin Smith wrote this. And he and I thought it was a really good response what he wrote on Facebook. Jamal Eigel wrote, and he talks about sort of the level playing field issue that the article, which I actually have not read yet, but he brings up that issue And so I read that response, which I thought was really well written, and then I was looking again at the Veronica Mars.
Wait,
Facebook.
It's a response to the Zach Braff and the Veronica Mars thing, or
no? He Jamal is responding to an article by Scott Johnson.
Okay.
Who is covering Ken Levine and Kevin Smith weighing in on Kickstarter, these mega Kickstarter projects, and the two of them, Ken Levine and Kevin Smith, are against it. You know, they're sort of a little bit, I think, echoing what I was talking about last week.
Oh, really? Kevin Smith is against it?
It appears to be, yeah. He is saying it's an unfair advantage, and that the Kickstarter should be for sort of, you know, essentially nobodies in a sense.
Oh.
And,
like me.
Exactly. Like all
like
of
us,
really. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm famous. I don't know about you guys,
right,
but I'm so effing famous. I'm like Don Draper famous. I don't know about you.
all of my action figures know exactly who I am.
Exactly.
So Jamal Eigel was responding to that. And then so I read that, and that got me thinking. And then I looked back at the Veronica Mars Kickstarter campaign and was reading just their page and what the producers had written. And, you know, of course, you can be cynical and say, oh, some studio intern wrote that and they were just trying to, you know, sound like they were appealing to the public. But, you know, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt that they're not lying and say that they probably were sincere, and that and the way that I read some of it, it sounded like it's Warner Brothers' call whether a movie is actually made, and that they were just trying to make an argument that there is interest and that Warner Brothers,
sure,
you know, wouldn't have to pay for it or for all of it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, Warner Brothers would still have to be convinced. And so that reminded me of kind of the struggles that Dig Comics has had, the documentary that I've helped produce and have worked on, and there's some announcements coming with that, so I can't really get into the whole thing, but so those reading those two things today got me thinking, and it started to, and then thinking back on Paul and I's conversation last week after we recorded the podcast, and you know, and I think Well, I think one thing that I didn't get a chance to say, or neglected to say, was that the thing I love about Kickstarter is that it is an open, you know, in the end, whether whether I like it or not, anybody can do it and can put up whatever they want, and that the masses will determine what gets funded, which I think is great. I think I'm still not totally on board with companies that are creating Kickstarter campaigns. Like in my email, I referenced a manga publisher who has, I think a couple times at least now, put up campaigns to publish or import and publish manga editions of you know, import and translate some work by a very well-known creator. Mm-hmm. And I you know, again, it's like, I'm sure that they would like to do this and pay for it if they felt like it was a sure bet, and that maybe they're in doubt whether it could work. But it's frustrating for me when a company that exists to take risks on properties is now eliminating that risk.
And they have backers, and they have, you know, I'm assuming they're a corporation, they're a public, you know, I mean, they're a company, so they're not like an individual taking a risk and just being like, this is my book. And I understand what you're saying. I guess what side was Jamal Engel on? What side was he on?
What's that?
He was for Zach Braff doing what he was going to do, or?
Yeah, well, he was saying that he feels that anybody should be able to do it, and regardless of what sort of celebrity you are, and one of the things he was saying is that he's, you know, even though he's, Jamal was saying, even though he sort of has a name among some comic fans, that he's still living check to check with a lot of people, by a lot of people, and so just because he has created a celebrity of some sort, and that he's
but Zach Braff is not living check to check. I can tell you that now.
That is a very different thing. But it's still you know, he probably could just throw down money and pay for the movie himself if he wanted to.
Yeah,
probably. Although I don't know. But
that's part of the problem that I have specifically, not necessarily with the Veronica Mars thing, but I have the problem that I have with the Zach Braff thing is, in all the interviews that I've listened to him on the radio, and he just did The Treatment, I think, last week, which is a radio show on KCRW and has a podcast. I haven't had a chance to listen to that interview, but from what I have heard him say is that he can't get financing to do it the way that he wants. Now, Zach Braff, how long was Scrubs on? Like 8 years? Like that, 8 years. And at some point in that run, he's at least making $100,000 an episode. So he is bringing in at least $2.2 million, and he's probably got a producer credit on the show as well. So he's making more than that. And forget about, you know, and then you can factor in what his agent takes and managers and lawyers and whatever else, because he's probably a corporate entity unto himself, correct? He is not like you and me or Paul.
No.
Where he's struggling to get money. You know, he could probably fund a small film. What was he looking for? 2 million or a million?
2.
Some 2?
Mhm.
2 million? He could put down $2 million of his own money. Now, on the other side of that is a long time ago when I was involved in the acting scene, I did know some indie producers, and I did know some indie producers who hadn't made names for themselves. And I had a friend who I haven't talked to in years, who had produced a couple of small, like, indie features that had gotten, like, minor distribution in cinemas. And he was getting ready to walk away from indie film because he had said the best, and I've heard this from other people, I don't know if you have, too, that the best way to throw away investment money is to invest it in a movie. Like, the best way to lose your money is to put it into a movie. Because so many movies get made in this town, as we all know, and they go nowhere. You know what I mean? So many. You know, even the ones that get DVD releases, who knows what money they're making back. You know, this is not Iron Man 3, like, which is what we were going to originally talk about, which we'll get to.
Yeah.
But, so my point is, what I'm thinking is that Zach Braff, much like everyone else in LA, a lot of people in Hollywood know, is that the best way to lose money is to put it into an indie feature. And these are smart guys. He's been around town for a long time. And I'm speculating, you know, is he knows that if he's going to produce an indie feature, he's probably going to lose that money in some one way or another, you know, or he may not be able to recoup that cash.
Well, from my understanding, he is going to be putting in, you know, some degree of money on this. The way I heard him describe it, the Kickstarter basically takes the place of a private investor in the whole process. It's not going to cover the entire thing, because I think, you know, I believe, you know, he's looking probably at a budget of, you know, $8 to $10 million for the, you know, for his movie. So yeah, what he makes from Kickstarter is not going to cover the entire movie. It's going to take the place of, you know, a single investor. But, you know, in that position, you know, that's one less person that you sort of have to, you know, be beholden to.
Well, then the other question for me is, who else is investing? Is he's putting in how much of the investment? If he's looking for $8 to $10 million, $2 million does not, that's not like completion funds. That's not even marketing budget. I mean,
but it's a start. You know what I mean? What I was just talking to Corey about, you know, just before you logged on, is that, you know, there's always going to be, you know, sort of the person who's more popular than you, who has like a better, you know,
sure,
a better chance of getting their project done.
Absolutely.
Most people aren't going to be able to go on K-Rock the morning that you do your Kickstarter and announce it and, you know,
yeah,
get that sort of media attention going right in.
Yeah.
You know, most people aren't going to be able to do that. Some
yeah
people are going to be able to do it. You know what
yeah
I mean?
Well, and there was also another interview with a guy who had gotten his funds through Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
For a feature film that he did, and they asked him about the Zach Braff and Veronica, and he's like, I'm not competing with them, you know, I can't,
right,
you know, just because somebody puts money into a Veronica Mars movie doesn't mean that they're going to put money into my movie, you know.
That was another point that I don't know if Jamal did, or maybe somebody in the comments on Facebook to his post said, that, you know, somebody, there's a Zach Braff this project. I think one of the arguments made in the article that he was responding to was that it's distracting and taking away from other projects. But somebody made a point that, you know, it's not like people are going to Kickstarter with like a budget and being like, okay, what am I going to spend my money on? Like,
yeah,
they're drawn to this Kickstarter page because they are intrigued and hopefully eventually excited by the project. So
yeah,
it's not like, you know, that money would have gone somewhere else. It's the money he raised is the money that is from the interest in him most primarily, and the movie, The Garden State, that, you know, that this is obviously going to be sort of working off of.
Yeah.
So you know, so then, like, you know, Jamal Igle's Kickstarter, which was very successful as well, although certainly not $2.5 million successful, but
yeah,
it surpassed his goal. You know, people contributed to that because they were excited, either they either liked his work or they were excited by a strong female fun superhero comic.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever, you know, or an all ages comic, and they wanted to support all ages comics, or they wanted to support creator owned comics or whatever. And so it's not like there's some sort of finite well where it's like, it's not like you go to the comic book store and it's like, okay, I
yeah
only have $20. It's a different
yeah
scenario.
Yeah, it definitely is a different scenario. I mean, I think I mean, it's a tough call for me because, I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, that's just what's Kickstarter going to do? Ban them? Like, and say, like, you know, Robert De Niro wants to make a movie one day and he goes to Kickstarter. Like, what is Kickstarter going to say? Like, no, Mr.
Right,
De Niro. You know,
it's, I'm sure they love it because it's great press. You know, it's
always
covered.
Yeah, of course. Of course they love it. So they're not going to stop it. So, I mean, basically, the whole argument is kind of moot, but, I mean, it does kind of, it's interesting to hear that Kevin Smith would be on the side of the little guy on that, because it's like, talk about a guy who, he could start a Kickstarter project tomorrow and probably fund Clerks 3, or at least part of the cost. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So it's interesting, but I mean, I've funded several Kickstarter things, contributed money to Kickstarter stuff, and I mean, it's all been through like an article that I've read on another site and been like, oh, hey, I'll check that out. You know what I mean?
You know, so, what will be really interesting is the day that someone figures out a way to use Kickstarter or some other thing in a way that people actually become investors in the movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, for whatever you get, you know, you'll get a certain percentage of profit, because then that gives people an incentive beyond, you know, a t-shirt or a sticker or, you know, admission to the movie or whatever it is. I mean, those perks are nice, but I mean, if you've got, let's say you have 1,000 people, you know, donate to your movie, 1,000 people who have like an investment in that movie are 1,000 people who are going to try to get other people to go out and see your movie.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the person who can master that is going to be a freaking genius.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. You should do
that. That's true. Well, there was actually a story today on the news about BitTorrent actually trying to legalize some of their service and make it sort of a donation service for like music artists. So, like, say somebody wanted to, whatever, I guess, torrent a movie, they would pay a certain amount, you know, for whatever it's worth, and they would just, like, if you were to make a movie and you made it available to BitTorrent, they would make it so that people could donate and say, oh, well, this is how much I want, and I want to donate and download it. So
cool.
That's interesting. That's like BitTorrent trying to go legit, which I don't know how that'll take.
Didn't work for Napster.
But will they be too legit to quit? That's the question.
I don't know. But it's I don't know how much of a conundrum that whole Kickstarter thing is, because quite honestly, if Zach Braff makes his money, you know, whatever, he'll go make his money. But that's the thing, is in a way, I feel like people, I mean, I don't know, the rewards are good, but are they getting tickets to his movie? I don't. I think, Paul, you would say that the rewards weren't all that great for the Zach Braff thing, right?
You know, it's there are a lot of tickets. I mean, you know, it's for the lower tier prices, you're pretty much getting, you know, the script, you're getting an admission maybe, but you're not getting you're not owning the film on, you know, you're not getting a download or a copy, a copy to see or things like that, you know.
There's screenings that you would get access to, cities, but
it's a little
soundtracks and stuff.
I felt like the perks for the Veronica Mars were better, you know, but you know, everybody sort of, you know, again, it's sort of uncharted territory as far as what they're, you know, what they're offering and stuff.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I guess it all depends if you made your Kickstarter goal as to whether you're pissed off at Zach Braff. I don't know. You know, it's tough. I haven't donated to Zach Braff or Veronica Mars because I never watched Veronica Mars, and the Zach Braff thing, I'm like, he can make money on his own. He doesn't need me, you know, to, you know, if he wants it bad enough, he can figure out a way. He's been in the business long enough. I don't really feel sympathy for Zach Braff not making a movie. Like somebody like Jamal Engel, who is, you know, a talented cartoonist, and I know that, you know, he's trying to make a project that he loves, I'm going to donate to that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And who obviously needs the money. You know,
to me,
it's like, I don't see a need for Zach Braff. Zach Braff can work in another project. He can find a movie. He can find a series. He's going to work. He's not, you know what I'm saying? But for somebody else who's like, Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's like my prejudice towards extremely wealthy people, but you know, I think that's kind of my position too.
That, you know, I mean, he's already passed his goal. Like he's fine. He's gonna be all right.
Yeah. He doesn't need me.
He's gonna pull through. He won't need my $10. But you know, maybe if he'd only made $15 and then and his goal was $2 million, I'd be like, oh, poor guy.
Yeah, exactly. Zach Braff doesn't need me. He doesn't need any of us. You know, he'll be fine. Even if he didn't make his goal, he would be fine. You know,
but I'd be happy to act in the movie. Zach.
Yeah, Corey will take a part. Corey will take a part in the film, of course. Well, speaking of movies, let's talk about Iron Man 3.
Yes, let's do it.
Yeah, awesome. Did you guys think?
Everyone's seen it, right?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. We've all seen it.
I held a Kickstarter to get my tickets.
Awesome. We should let everyone know that we're going to spoil the shit out of it. So, if you haven't seen it, turn this off right now. Turn it off. Just go away. Walk away. So who wants to get started? Who wants to, you know, begin the conversation?
Me.
All right, Paul, you go.
And I'm gonna jump right out here and like jump to the major spoiler because I want to get your guys' opinion on this.
All right.
Oh, really? You're not gonna ease in
the Mandarin.
The Mandarin. Yeah. Well, what did you think?
My question for you.
What's the question?
Was he a red herring? Or was he legitimately the brains behind everything?
I don't know. I was thinking about that too later on. I was like, is he really a patsy?
I think he was.
Yeah, I think he was. I don't know, but there is a part of me that's like wants to imagine like the people at Marvel like,
yeah, there's a part of me that's just like, dude, he's the Kaiser Soze of this thing. <Yeah.
laughs> I think you're putting a little bit too much into the script of Iron Man. I know what you're saying, and I would love it if that were the case. Like I would be like, that's genius. But I think I was
watching for that for that turn, you know, and I think we would have gotten a little bit more line, you know, a little bit more hints at that if that were the case. At the very least, something at the tail end after the credits or something, you know. Turning back into the terrorist character and being like...
Okay. I was just wondering because part of me was like, he's a patsy. He's just been used. But then part of me is like, what if he's the Kaiser Soze of this thing?
Well, I think what could happen is that in Iron Man 6 or something, the real Mandarin shows up.
Yeah, I could see that more than. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting. What was your initial reaction to it? Because I don't know about you guys, because when I saw it, like when I saw the scene starting, you know, I was like, and part of me was that way because I thought that the Mandarin in real life was like a buffoon and the thing was an act, not that he was an actor, you know, being set up as propped up as the Mandarin, but that he actually was the Mandarin, but he was all into cocaine and ladies, you know, and the whole terrorist thing was like a facade. And I kind of had a problem with that. But then once it eased into the fact that he was like an actor to play the role, I was like, okay, like I can go with this. And then as it went on into like sort of a wider conspiracy of like, this is the military industrial complex, like propping up icons, you know, so that we can keep the war on terror going. I was like, oh, all right, like I'll buy that. I mean, there was a little bit of disappointment because I wanted to see some magic ring action flying on the screen. But I was okay with it. What about you guys? Were you just like, this is brilliant, like right away?
I enjoyed it. I mean, I was still waiting for like the full reveal. I don't remember starting to be disappointed. I thought you know, I thought it was fun. Like I didn't mind it. I'm sure that there are people who are like, you know, that's not the real Mandarin, and you know, and
the
I do
real Mandarin.
It would have been not, you know, the real life person that walks around in the streets.
Yeah.
But I do miss a little bit the rings. I would have liked if there was some rings somewhere, but yeah, that's all right. Yeah. I thought it was fun. That was a clever twist. I didn't mind it. I liked it.
Overall, okay. Well, then we'll get past like the Mandarin issue. But overall, I was really, really impressed with the totality of the movie. You know, it did a great job of taking Tony Stark back out of the armor. You know what I mean? And it's kind of funny. I was talking to somebody else, and he was like, "Oh, wait a minute." He said it's sort of like Batman. You know, it's like the last Batman movie. How Batman, he wasn't Batman for the for the movie. He was, you know, Bruce Wayne. But it's a little different here.
No, it's different because Amy and I kind of talked about that, and I remember the last one. Batman, what was it called? Rises or whatever the heck?
Dark Knight Rises, right.
Dark Knight Rises. I remember thinking in the middle of the movie, like, where the fuck is Batman? Like, where's Batman? Like, he hasn't shown up yet. Mm-hmm. And in this one, like, the reason that I realized I was thinking, like, where's Batman is because really that character, even in the beginning, even though he's called Bruce Wayne, like, nothing of what makes Batman Batman was in that movie for such a long time. And even though he's out of the armor, Tony Stark is, like, what makes the character Tony Stark is up front and present during the whole movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't mind it at all. And
me neither.
Enjoyed it. I did. There's a friend on Facebook who was like, "Oh, it's just a 2-hour toy commercial,"
I saw
and
that.
I don't see that. I mean, I could see that argument for the first, or and probably more so the second one with War Machine, and there's like, you know, just armors everywhere, but you don't really get the sort of deluge of armors till the very end. But like,
yeah, and you barely see them.
Almost 3/4 of it is Tony running around with no armor whatsoever.
Yeah. I completely agree with you. It's really funny because it struck me very much like the Avengers. I watched the Avengers over the weekend again, just because I wanted to get my double dose of Marvel, and I was watching it, and I was very tired. Like, this was Saturday night. I saw Iron Man Sunday night. I was really tired, and I was sitting there, and I was like, Amy went to bed, my wife went to bed, and like midway through the movie, she's like, I really want to watch the rest of this, but I'm tired. And I was like, I'm gonna be up in a couple of minutes, and I kept watching it, and I couldn't shut it off because the feeling that I had with Iron Man 3 was very much the feeling that I had with the Avengers. Like, when I first saw the Avengers in the theater, I was watching it, and I was like, I don't know about this. This is kind of cheesy, running away from the explosion. And then it just kept building and building and building. And that's what happened with Iron Man 3. Like, Iron Man 3 started, like, back in 1999, and Jon Favreau's got, like, the long hair wig.
Yeah.
And, like, it struck me as very cheesy. And I was talking to somebody at work, and you know how, like, the first 10 minutes of, like, a script is supposed to establish it, and if the film is not established in the first 10 minutes, it's very hard for the viewer to get back into the film, you know, mm-hmm. what I mean, if the first 10-20 minutes isn't great. And that's the way, like, the Avengers and Iron Man 3 was for me. Like, the first 10-15 minutes, I was like, and then it starts building from there, and I was like, oh, this is great. And then by the end of the movie, I just had a fantastic time, you know.
Yeah,
I definitely felt the slowness of the beginning of Avengers. I didn't feel it as much with Iron Man 3. I thought,
oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying with the flashback, but I was so sort of like, why are we seeing this? So I was so sort of intrigued why we were in this flashback that I was okay with it.
Yeah, like the stuff that the flashback, and then, you know, Pepper being in the office, and John Favreau, Happy Hogan? Like,
yeah, one of those alliterative Stan Lee names there.
Yeah, but being, you know, with the, you know, oh, the human resources talk and all that, I was like, okay, can we just get to the, you know, I don't really, but it was good. I mean, it definitely established something. But like with what you were saying, Paul, as far as Tony Stark and Corey, you were saying like him being out of the armor, I thought what they did a really good job of is like, what do you do with the character who has everything, you know, like how can you make him relatable to the audience? And basically what they did was they just stripped him of everything. They just took everything away. Yeah. You know, and that's where his character kind of like shone through, right? Because he was like, okay, I don't have the armor. And it takes him back to the very first movie where he's like, I've got to figure out how to survive on my wits, you know?
Right.
That was very smart.
And, you know, and what was really good about the, you know, the kid in the movie, you know, throwing the kid in, because kids in movies usually are just ridiculous.
Disasters.
It could have gone bad.
This one, you know, granted, I think some of the scenes went a little long with the kid, but overall it was really successful because it just reminded him of what was important. The whole thing
is,
you know, like, you're a mechanic, build something, you know.
Yeah.
That's what you do as a mechanic and as an inventor, is you find the problem and you solve the problem, you know.
Yeah.
And what I loved is that he didn't build, you know, like an Iron Man suit.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he didn't, you know, he just tackled the problem and the immediate problem. And the whole movie was really cool because it sort of brought him back to, it's more of a detective story in a way. It's like bringing him back to being someone who solves problems. And I also love the way that, you know, he was having his little freakouts, you know, about the Avengers thing. The anxiety attack there, what's interesting is, you know, it's because, you know, it's never really said what's the root of his anxiety.
Yeah.
I think the root of his anxiety is that he's no longer the center of attention. You know what I mean?
That's interesting.
He was the center of the universe before when he was Iron Man. Now you've got gods on Earth and everything like that. He's no longer, you know, the most powerful person on the planet.
Yeah.
You know, you know, it's sort of about him accepting his order in the new Marvel universe.
Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting point, because you know, I definitely really loved that part too, because it definitely grounded him, you know, again, it brought him down to Earth, where it was like, I can dress up in a suit of armor, and like you said, like, there's aliens and, you know, things, I almost got trapped in another dimension. Like, he's the only one at the end of the Avengers that actually saw, like, the giant starship, like, how big it was. And, you know, it probably plays into a lot of what you're talking about, but I know that if any one of us saw something like that and knew that something was out there like that and had no idea when it was coming, it would probably screw with our heads too, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
You know, it's almost like that whole thing of like, yeah, like seeing God or something, where you're just like, oh my, you know. And I really enjoyed the fact that he couldn't cope with something, you know what I mean? Like, he couldn't figure it out, and it wasn't just like, I'm a workaholic, I need to be in the basement building 5 bajillion sets of armor, you know what I mean?
But even that was a great, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of, it started as a throwaway joke, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what Shane Black really does well, is he has these things that are throwaway jokes that later pay off in the script, you know.
Yeah.
And the reason why he's been so obsessed with all of these different armors, and the reason why he creates all of these different armors, is because he's trying to create like something that will take care of every single problem that he can imagine. It's why he's got a Hulkbuster armor. It's why he's got, you know, a stealth armor. It's why he's got all of these things. You know, and what I thought was really great is, you know, the whole movie is him, you know, sort of coming to terms with the fact that, like, he just can't control everything.
Yeah.
But what he can control is himself.
Yeah. It was really, I mean, it's really interesting on how many different levels this worked on, because if you're looking at it just from like a basic, you know, oh, it's an action movie and there's armor and, you know, and we were talking about the Mandarin and I think that and all the other stuff, I think it's interesting to me that they very deftly handled not offending anybody. You know what I mean? Like, they rode that line where, because I was watching the beginning of the movie and I was like, oh, the Mandarin, this thing mm-hmm. is not going to play in the Middle East. And then, mm-hmm. you know, they have that turn, and then they also have the incidents like where with Pepper wearing the armor and how Pepper is kind of the final, you know, one to take out the villain. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So they really, the script did a really good job of like flipping expectations on their head and sort of putting other characters in the forefront or moving them around in a way that you didn't expect, you know? Mm-hmm. Like that end with Pepper is like, you know, any other movie, you would need the hero to be the one to take out the villain. Like, no, there has to be a big fight at the end of the movie. It has to be climax, you know, a big thing, and the hero has to be, but in this one, he's actually saved by his, you know, girlfriend, mm-hmm. and she's the one that delivers the final blow, you know? And that to me was genius. You know, I was like, and to do it in such a way where I didn't feel like, ah, the hero didn't take him out, you know what I mean? That was really smart. I thought that was really smart writing.
Yeah, that was good. And I think too. I mean, an actor friend of mine mentioned. In fact, while we were making that video I made, she was saying how cool it is that, I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow is like in her 40s, and she's in, you know, one of the biggest Hollywood movies of the summer, and she, as you mentioned, saves the hero and looks fantastic doing it. I mean, she looks I kind of thought she was probably going to end up having powers of some sort, but like she just looked cool. I was like, I was like, I want to see a She-Hulk movie now. I mean, that just looks, she just looked fantastic, you know, looked so tough, and it just like, you know, she looked like a superhero. I was like, that's pretty cool.
Now, when she falls into the flames, because I thought she was dead. I was like, did they just kill Pepper Potts? That's awesome. And then, like, a second went by, and I had to turn to Amy, and I'm like, oh, she's not dead. And Amy's, like, trying to pay attention. She's like, what? Shut up. And I'm like, no, she's not dead, because she got injected with that stuff. Amy's like, oh, okay. Like, yeah, I was like, oh, she's not going to die. But, yeah, I love that bit. I do think that Don Cheadle was a little bit wasted in the movie. I mean, what did you guys think about that?
I don't know. I thought he, I mean, you're right. He didn't really shine until the end. But I thought that sort of sequence when he and Tony are kind of sneaking around that shipyard there.
Yeah,
I love that scene because, you know, Tony just seems without his armor and he's just totally incompetent. Like, I love when he just pops up over the thing and he's like, too quick, I didn't see anything.
Yeah.
You know, and then he's like, it's too far away, you could never hit that light with one shot, and then he does it in one shot. You know, so he's definitely like the competent, you know, he's taking people down. He's, you know, he can take care of himself. And Tony's kind of like scurrying around behind him like, wait, what are we doing?
Exactly.
So I think he definitely had his moment. I hear you, you know, the War Machine, there were some sequences in the War Machine or the Iron Patriot stuff earlier that was a little like, but I thought he had a moment.
There was a lot that they packed into this, and I thought they did a much more successful job of the, you know, sort of multiple hero, multiple villain kind of thing than Iron Man 2 did. As a matter of fact, this is really sort of one of the first movies, what superhero movies, that's done the multiple villain thing really well. That juggled that, you know, to the point where, you know, there's still a degree of suspense, and, you know, like, I honestly didn't know who that final battle would be. Would it be with the Mandarin? Would it be with, you know, the first extremist soldier? You know, I mean, it was interesting because, like, the way they had set it up, you weren't really sure, you know, who was pulling the strings.
And I
really like that. You know, the other thing that I was really impressed with too was what they had with the Mandarin and those sequences, those video sequences that were directed by he had a lot of different like visual artists who worked on this thing. I thought it was interesting, like the sort of the video art that went into like the Mandarin's broadcast, you know, that that brought in like little clips of war footage, plus you had like a lot of infomercial clips thrown in there and things. It was kind of cool to see somebody who's sort of well versed in sort of the art world of cinema, you know, making a bigger budget action movie.
Yeah.
It's cool that they got featured like that. That's really
cool. I think the Mandarin, it was just really interesting because it's especially with the Boston bombing having just occurred, like I was watching those scenes and I was just like, wow. And I wonder when that bombing happened if anyone at Marvel was like, shit, man, we've got a movie full of people like human bombs, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like and talk about having the guts to just, you know, be like, you know what, we're gonna release it. You know what I mean? Like just standing by it, because I mean, there's nothing really gratuitous in the movie. Like, I mean, you don't see, you know, like you would see like in a Zero Dark Thirty or Black Hawk Down or something like that, where, you know, but that was great. I mean, I haven't read the Extremis arc of Iron Man, but I was just hoping that it was going to be Nitro from the Captain Marvel, but like the human bomb, the guy that just like blows himself up and like reforms himself. I was like, oh, Nitro. But it ended up being a bunch of people that, you know. And that was kind of cool too, you know.
In the Extremis storyline, it's really one person who's the Extremis soldier. Although it's really fascinating. If you look at the first Iron Man movie and the third Iron Man movie, you're just like, wow. Warren Ellis owns so much of the ideas that went into so many of the successful ideas that went into Iron Man.
And the artist on...
And Adi Granoff, yeah, definitely.
Well, he worked on the concept art, some of the concept art for the movie, too.
Right, yeah. But the first movie is pretty much a huge chunk of the first movie and a big chunk of this movie were taken directly from that comic.
So in the Extremis comic, is it guys blowing themselves up?
Like, no, it's different. It's a little different. The Extremis, it's got the same qualities that allows the human body to sort of rewrite its DNA code. And what made it different, and I was really sort of impressed that they didn't like sort of go this route, although they might in the sequel. Tony injects himself with a modified version of the Extremist. Basically the Extremist soldier like just pretty much nearly kills him, you know, like just crushes his arm, you know, like breaks his legs, he's near death. He injects himself with a modified version of the Extremist virus to heal himself, but he also, with the modified version, he's able to basically summon his armor from inside of his body now and network himself, like able to command everything mentally, you know, the way the armor was sort of flying up. He's able to control all of that, you know, without any kind of an interface now, and he's able to access satellite systems and everything just by thinking about it now. So it really brought his sort of his power level up even greater notch in the comics.
They definitely did change a lot too. I mean, they really did, you know, truly adapt it. And Killian's like, basically a minor character in the comic.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting. Because Killian, I thought, was going to be, I can't remember who the old Iron Man, you know, villain used to be, the guy that owned Rocks and Oil or whatever.
Oh, that's right.
I can't remember.
Hammer.
Justin Hammer. I thought he was going to be Justin Hammer, but it's interesting.
Has there ever been like an actual person who has run AIM?
I don't know.
I thought it was Arnim Zola.
Might be right. I think it was Arnim Zola to start off with, and then MODOK might have taken over. Oh, I want to see MODOK in a movie. That would be so freaky.
Oh, that'd be hilarious.
Yeah, but what about the action sequences, guys? Because I was just like the sequence where the Malibu house gets nuked. I was just like, oh my god,
this is insane.
Yeah,
it was fantastic. Like, just like, you know, I mean, obviously a little over the top, and you know, with the armor assembling around, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow. It was just a fantastic. Like, I that's when I really got sucked in, where I was just like, this is crazy. And then, you know, there's a part of me also that's watching the movie. There's a couple of things I thought, because I really think that at this point, A, movie audience is going to have to start thinking like comic fans, in that, like, hey, Galactus landed in Manhattan and it's just a fan. Where are the Avengers? You know, like, it's really funny to me that there would be like three black helicopters, you know, nuking his mansion, and that the SHIELD helicarrier wouldn't come like out of the sky, or like, you know.
Well, I thought of that, but then when it's revealed that the vice president's actually behind it, I just figured they probably were given orders. Oh, you know, don't worry about, you know.
Yeah, maybe I could see that.
Everybody go in different direct. You know, everybody go that way.
I could see that.
I feel like people aren't going to have to necessarily be that way with the movies. I think that people now will sort of accept, okay, an Iron Man movie is an Iron Man movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but there's definitely a part of me where it's like when the Mandarin stuff starts happening in the beginning.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's terrorism. Where's Captain America? Like, why is it Captain America in the Middle East kicking that guy's ass? You know what I mean? Like, that would be the first person you would send, in my opinion, you know? Why is Tony dealing with the terrorism? So, and it's funny, because when I talked with Amy afterwards, she's like, yeah, I kept thinking, like, where's Thor? And then she'd be like, oh yeah, this is an Iron Man movie. So, I mean, there's that sort of, you know, willing suspension of disbelief, where you have to be like, you know, okay, none of the other guys are going to show up. You know, he's on his own. So,
yeah,
you know, there's definitely, you know, because, I mean, in the second movie, SHIELD is like everywhere. They're just showing up. They're like, hey, Tony, what's up? Hey, I know stuff about your dad. You know, and in this movie, there's none of that, you know.
Hey,
and
I actually like that. I like the fact that, like, I mean, it felt in the beginning of the movie, you got the sense that he had just sort of retreated away from everyone. You know,
You
know, he'd left New York. He'd come back to Los Angeles, you know.
Yeah.
And I still love seeing Los Angeles in the Iron Man movies, because I love that the West Coast has its own superhero.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, growing up, you didn't have that. They were all in New York City and stuff, up until the West Coast Avengers, right?
Yeah.
So.
But, well, there was that little brief moment that Daredevil lived in Haight-Ashbury,
San Francisco. That's right. That's so funny. And then what about, like, the whole, like, Air Force One thing, and using the Iron Patriot to kid...
That was
fantastic.
Great rescue, you know? Again.
That got an applause in our theater.
He worked the problem. You know?
Yeah, yeah. There was a lot of applause. And it was interesting, because it was so well shot, too. Like, all the skydiving. Like, you know, in old movies, how you, like an old James Bond movie, you would see a skydiving sequence and you'd be like, oh, that's obviously like third unit photography, or if you were lucky, it was like, you know, stock footage, or, you know, somebody skydiving. And this was just like, wow, everything looked crystal clear, and you definitely got the sense that you could almost see, like, the people who were falling with him and like know who they were, like, oh, that's not a stunt person, that's like, well, obviously it is, but you know what I mean, like, that's an actual, like, that's the same person that it was in the other shot, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that was a really well-made movie, and, you know, I was just so sort of happy that this is the kickoff to their sort of second phase of, you know, Marvel filmmaking.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, I mean, 170 something million over the weekend, in one weekend, and almost 700 million in like 10 days worldwide. I mean, Thor has got a lot to live up to. I mean, that first Thor trailer, I mean, I liked it, but is it going to drag in that kind of money?
I don't think so. And I don't think they have the same expectations for Thor. I mean, Iron Man was always sort of the headliner of the Avengers cast.
Right.
But is it because of Robert Downey Jr.?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, really? You think that he's just such a talent that he carries it?
Well, I mean, his movies, both Iron Man and Iron Man 2, I think did better than Captain America and Thor.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
so I think
that's got to be a factor, you know? I mean, there's something amazingly watchable about him as an actor.
Yeah.
You know, that even, look, I think Chris Evans is fantastic. I think that, who's the one who plays Thor?
Chris Hemsworth.
Chris Hemsworth. I think they're great, but they don't have, like, that amazing magic, movie star magic that Robert Downey Jr. has. There's something incredibly appealing about Robert Downey Jr. I feel sorry in advance for the person who has to take the role after him.
Yeah, because there's going to be someone.
It's going to be tough.
It is going to be tough, but I mean that character. I mean it's going to be like James Bond, I would imagine, unless they just like reboot it every couple of years. But the plan is to get to an Avengers 3, right? As far as I know.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you heard, but they're having trouble now negotiating for Avengers 2, never mind 3.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, but at this point, they couldn't, because they've got to do something, because they've already got Iron Man 3, you've got Thor 2, Captain America 2. Those movies, I mean, Captain America 2 is, I think, still being filmed. Thor is probably done with principal photography. What are you going to do, just recast the whole thing for Avengers 2? I mean,
no, they probably just have a new Iron Man and keep everybody else.
Really? And you don't think that would be hard to deal with?
That would be just really disappointing. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, that would just be really, because I know that, I mean, I could see getting rid of Scarlett Johansson, getting rid of Jeremy Renner. You can't get rid of the Hulk because, like, he's such a, you have to have him in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, I could see them bringing in other Avengers and stuff. From what I understand, the rumor is that Joss Whedon already has, like, Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch in there.
Right.
So, I don't know. Awesome. It's interesting, because the Avengers is such a huge cast. But then you've got the also-rans. Who wants them, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be a tricky thing. I'm hoping that they're going to be able to, you know, I'm just hoping that they're going to be able to keep these, you know, balls up in the air with this great big juggling act that Marvel's been doing.
So
it's kind of interesting to see the, you know, these issues come up with paying the actors when, you know, it seems awfully familiar for compensating creators that created these characters.
That's
well,
true.
Well, that was the, I think Jimmy Kimmel did a joke there that they were setting up a Kickstarter for Robert Downey Jr. to do Avengers or something.
Oh, jeez. That's funny. Yeah, I mean, but still, it's like hard for me to cry for Robert Downey Jr. because he's the one that got paid the most. I mean, he made $80 million off of Avengers, and God knows what he's going to make off of Iron Man 3. I think it's the other two, Chris Hemsworth, well, 4 or 5, right? Chris Evans.
Yeah.
Well, and if that Hollywood Deadline article is, or whatever it's called, is correct, it sounds like Robert Downey Jr. is a bit like, you know, obviously, yes, he's making an obscene amount of money.
Yeah.
But I think he's in a way, you know, he's, from what I understand, is helping the other actors in using his weight as sort of the biggest celebrity to get everybody else a good deal too.
Yeah, I mean, I know that they lowballed Scarlett Johansson for Iron Man 2. I don't know what she was paid for, Avengers, But still, I mean, it's like, to me, it's like rich people's problems. It's like, oh, you didn't get paid the full $8 million. You know, because in that Deadline article, they said like Chris Hemsworth got like $8 million for Snow White and the Huntsman. And I'm like, oh, poor baby. You know, it's like, it's hard for me to sympathize with you, you know, when you're, but then again, you look at how much the studios, you know, they're all going to make, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's not all off the movie. That's licensing and product and stuff like that. I mean,
yeah,
gosh,
but how much of those licenses and products are based off their images?
Yeah, yeah. You know,
their
guess.
Likeness.
And I'm curious to see if, I mean, I'll never find out, but I would be curious to find out if, I mean, obviously Downey Jr. is getting money for the license, the product with his face on it, and I wonder if he got a deal like Jack Nicholson did for the Joker, which is like anything Iron Man. Like Jack Nicholson was like anything Joker, from what I understand. Like anything Joker, I guess around the time of that movie, like he just made money off of that. So
like anytime, like if somebody made a joke, he got some money.
No, not quite that bad, but you know, so it's just, it's it'd be interesting if like the $80 million was just from the movie, or was it because of the licensing and all the tie-ins and stuff like that? Because if it's just from the movie, he's still even making more money on top of that. So I don't know. But so do you think they, so it'll go like, it'll be Thor, Captain America, Avengers 2, and then they'll have to like, oh, Guardians of the Galaxy,
Guardians of
right?
the Galaxy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, you heard the latest casting rumor on that, right?
I heard that it might be Doctor Who.
David Tennant for
yeah.
Rocket Raccoon.
Which gets me excited.
I know. And it's so much...
That was so much better than...
Yeah, it made me smile after hearing some of the other, you know, things that were being thrown around.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah. I could just see him doing a bang-up job with that. That would just be... Because he's got a great voice, too. Like, just like a great animated, you know, voice. And I think he could probably pull it off, you know. He's great. I guess he got nominated for an Emmy for something, too, David Tennant.
Oh, for his... is that for his miniseries that he has
Yeah,
there?
I'm not sure. I have to look it up, but... excited for him, but that's really great. So at this point, Iron Man 4, I mean, that would have to come after Avengers, or do you think that they just like reassess after Avengers 2?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the way I did read that, the way Iron Man ends, certainly it does leave it open for it that to be the end,
yeah.
as far as that franchise.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I think that's a satisfying end. I think I would not be upset if that. Well, I would miss more of Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man, but
it would be nice
Iron
if they
Man.
Went out on a high note.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
exactly.
Don't you think
exactly.
that, because it's interesting, because it seems like almost at the end of every, except for the first one, at the end of the second one, they almost gave him an out. You know what I mean? They were like, oh, you don't play with others. You know, we don't know if we want you to be involved that much with the Avengers. You remember that? And they even alluded to it in the Avengers movie where he's like, I thought
right.
I wasn't, you know, going to be part
yeah.
of your little team.
I think that was probably a bit of a setup for the conflict among the characters. And
Yeah, I also
America's
think it might have been a way to minimize his involvement. And now, obviously, you know, I mean, could they do a second Avengers without Iron Man? I mean, that's the question, right?
Yes.
I think that would be tough. I mean,
it would be tough. But or could they do it with just having, you know, the suit and getting him as a voiceover? You know what I mean?
Oh, wow. Hmm. I don't think he would ever go for that, though. He'd probably have to be paid a mint for that, you know? Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting conundrum there. But, oh, wow. That's a bummer. I mean, I would like him to be in them. I think he's really kind of cemented... you know, what we think of as the character now.
I agree.
Absolutely.
But you know, the fact is, you know, he's not going to be able to do it forever.
Oh,
and
no.
It seems... I don't know how long in advance, you know, they sort of have to start thinking about that, but it seems like it might have to be sooner than later if
sure.
the money's becoming an issue.
Sure. Well, it's so all we just have to worry that the next Iron Man is not Roger Moore type, To Sean Connery's James Bond.
You know? Oh, Roger Moore would be horrible, dude. Have you seen him lately?
Not him, but you know what I'm saying. So we all loved Iron Man 3.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think my dilemma is, was it better than the first Iron Man?
I think character-wise, I don't think so, but action-wise, definitely.
Yeah, I feel it had like great action sequences, and I feel like it was a much more challenging and engaging story.
Yeah, agreed.
In a lot of ways, but as far as, you know, whether it's a better movie, it's tough. That first one just did such a great job of setting up the Marvel universe.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing though I did feel when I rewatched it was that the ending is it's a little anticlimactic. It's a little like this, like the Iron Man 3 definitely has the stronger ending.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It's a big finale. The first one, it's a little bit, oh, okay, I guess that's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think you may be right about that. Because I think even the confrontation with Ironmonger is a little bit like, oh, typical Hollywood movie. But I think that, you know, with one, they were just struggling for it not to suck. You know what I mean? Because so many superhero movies up to that point had really sucked, you know, really bad. And I think that they kind of discovered a brand new formula, you know, with Iron Man, where it's like, oh, we can make it work. You know, cast a really good actor. Duh. You know, it's like, I mean, a big part of the reason why it works. I mean, and I heard an interview with Jon Favreau, I think on the Kevin Pollak chat show, where he said, like, once Robert Downey Jr. was cast, he's like, we were on autopilot. Like, he's like, I directed the movie and everything like that, but a big reason why that movie works is because of Robert Downey Jr., you know? And apparently, isn't it funny how, you know, they fought his casting from the beginning, you know? They did not want Robert Downey Jr. in there because he was a mess, you know?
Oh, he had been a mess, but, you know, he had had... again, and that's, it comes back again to Shane Black. You know, Shane Black took a really big risk on him with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah,
and you know,
it's a great movie.
It's really cool that, you know, he was able to repay the favor later on down the road, because I think Shane Black is a really, really talented guy.
Yeah,
and I feel like what he brought to with Iron Man 3. To the Marvel Universe is something that is going to be important, because it's a big transition.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Shane Black wrote the first Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, he was and of course he was in Predator. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow. That's great. Yeah, because I don't know about you guys, but I love that first Lethal Weapon. I remember, and I still think it holds up. I mean, as crazy as Mel Gibson's gotten and all that, I still think, and it's basically like the template for all the action movies that followed it, right? That and Die Hard, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was the first movie to sort of be self-aware about the whole, you know, oh, you know, I'm retiring in a week, you know, nothing's gonna happen now.
Yeah, I know, right? You know, that's so funny.
It sort of played up on those, you know, little movie cliches, and, you know, took them, you know, poked fun at them, yet at the same time told a really entertaining movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's really funny because I mean, I even love the credit sequence at the end of Iron Man 3.
Yeah, I did too. I've heard a lot of people say that they hated it, but I thought it was fantastic. Yeah.
Why would they hate it?
There's definitely a retro sort of feel to it, but it was fun. I liked it.
I loved it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was just fun. You know, it reminded me a little bit of the cartoons. You know, those poorly animated yet really fun Marvel cartoons that they started out with. You know,
well, it reminded me of like old, like I don't want to say like Grindhouse, but like 60s sort of, well, like
60s, 70s. Yeah, you know, kind of
like montage. You know, like sort of thing.
And they had a fantastic energy to them. But you know, some people,
and the music,
it's indulgent. It's like, well, yeah,
it's,
you know,
indulgent. It's, the whole movie's indulgent. I mean,
it's like, have you like met your main character?
Yeah, I know, right? It's like indulgent. How could you Like, that seems silly to me. I mean, that's the thing, is like, going into that's why I really like this. I mean, it just played on so many levels. I mean, politically, it had like a little like, hey, the military industrial cop, blah, 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 Dick Cheney, you know, and all this other like humor and action. Like, that's kind of why, like, the more I think about it after I left, I'm like, wow, they really pulled something off that in especially today's, you know, horrid landscape of movies, you know, they did a really good job, you know.
And what's cool is that's what Marvel used to be about too, you know. Do you remember the Captain America series where he, you know, he was fighting the mysterious bad guy who turned out to be the president of the United States? And it threw Captain America into such a, you know, spiral that he turned into Nomad and all that stuff. It's like, you know, Marvel wasn't afraid to sort of be political and to be like a part of its times. And that's what I really appreciated about this movie, is that it was Marvel in like the best possible way.
It definitely had, you know, it definitely gave me a feel of the heyday of Marvel, you know, even though it's pulling off of like Warren Ellis's run. I just felt like, oh, everything's funny and everything's like, and there's a little bit of like, there was a little bit of political messaging in there, but it didn't hammer you over the head with it. Like, I think the most blatant thing was when Guy Pearce was like, you know, that was the great thing. Like, he didn't even talk about the plot. Like, it's just like one line where he's like, you know, commerce, you know, it's like you build the war and we'll, you know, it's like it goes in a big circle. Like, there's a war and, you know, it builds on fear. And they just broke it down to like one sentence, like right when he was going to punch somebody. I can't remember what the exact sentence is, but I was like, wow, he just summed up his old plot without monologuing. You know what I mean? Yeah. Which was great, you know. So
there's just enough subversiveness to just being, you know, just drop it in and then carry on with the Hollywood movie.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It was a nice balance.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess all in all, we loved Iron Man 3, and as long as Marvel doesn't start kickstarting their movies, we'll be okay with them.
That is correct.
No kickstarting for Marvel. They don't need it, I don't think, at this point.
But if they did, I'd kick in if they had a really cool T-shirt.
Yeah. Well, they do have really cool T-shirts. I can attest to that. So great. Any other thoughts on Iron Man 3?
Just that I really have to give props to that kid in the Iron Man 3. That he really nice acting.
You are right. You're absolutely right. I mean, that could have been disastrous. That could have been like
a really painful.
Yeah, it could have been really painful, and they pulled it out. And speaking of the political thing, like, I just love that whole moment when Tony goes into the bar in the small town, and he sits down with the woman and starts to tell her, like, your son didn't kill himself. Like, that to me just seemed like such a human moment, and the way that she looked at him and stuff, like, it just like kind of like tugged at my heartstrings, especially with everything that's been going on for like the past 10, 12, 13 years. It's just like, oh man, like, you know, because there is a lot of stuff in the news about veterans not getting the treatment that they want, and talk about, you know, I mean, like you said, Paul, like, they just had so much courage sticking that sort of thing in like a mainstream action movie, where it's like, have we forgotten about these guys? Like, in the build up to war, we were all like, support our troops. And now that we get home and so many of them are maimed and stuff, you know, they're waiting for months and months for any of their benefits. And I just thought that was such a nice little moment, you know, where it's like, you guys have not been forgotten, you know? And I was like, wow. I don't know.
I think there's, you know, and absolutely, I completely agree. And I think I think the movie took a lot of opportunities to find those moments where usually something like that, where it's a very minor role, the acting would be fine. It would, and you'd just move on. But like you said, like that woman was really effective. And there were a lot of scenes like that where parts that would be just throwaway, just put some, whoever, just as long as they look fine, that's good enough.
Yeah.
Got some lines where they got to play, like the two guards with Tony Stark when he's
that's
strapped
right.
up to the bed frame.
Yeah.
Like, they had like plenty of like really funny lines, and they delivered them really well. Like, they were really good at their lines. And the one guy that runs in, he's and they're like about to shoot each other, and he's like, forget it, these guys are weird, and he like bails.
Yeah,
them,
yeah. That was brilliant.
Like, you know, for like bit player acting roles, that's great.
Yeah. You could tell like a whole lot of thought went into everything. Like, there's one scene where like I remember, was it on the plane or on the oil rig? Like a gun, because like they were gonna kidnap the president, or the president was in trouble, and I was like, oh man, is this president gonna be like a puss like in every other movie where the president gets kidnapped? And he actually picks up the gun and tries to defend himself, and I was like, oh cool, he's not a puss. I mean, you know, he actually tried to. I mean, unless it's Harrison Ford in Air Force One, you usually see the president as some kind of like milksop who's like, okay, you know, go ahead, take me away, you know. And just little, like, you're absolutely right, Corey. Little touches like that, like, made this like so special to me, you know. And I don't know, it's such a contrast with the Batman movie, you know, where the last Batman movie, I know, Paul, you really liked it, but there was just such a, you know, touch of, it's weird, like a touch of optimism through this movie, you know.
And
a feeling of like, of lightness to it, that even though there's some heavy shit going on, like, it's we're still having fun with this, you know what I mean? So
yep.
I don't know.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm hoping that they have that with Man of Steel, but I don't know. We'll see. Uh-huh. Anyway, so we've talked about Kickstarter, Iron Man 3, and I guess that wraps us up for another episode of Part-Time Fanboy.
All right.
Which, again, we forgot to introduce who we were. Damn it. So I'm Christian Horn. That's Paul Edwards.
That's me.
Corey Blake. And hopefully we'll be back with another episode of Part-Time Fanboy real soon.